Hello everybody and welcome to our talk about white box cryptography. This is Dmitry Kovratovich from the University of Luxembourg and he will present this talk to us. Please, could I ask you to remain seated until the talk ends or to exit very quietly because it's disrespectful to the speaker if you leave here in a loud way. And also there will be no sitting in the aisles. I'm sorry if you need power, tape it or unplug it. Okay, we're ready to start. The floor is yours. Please give a warm round of applause to Dmitry Kovratovich.
Hello, everyone. So, my talk is devoted to white box cryptography today. It's a survey talk. It's partially inspired by the research we are doing at the University of Luxembourg in our cryptography group together with Professor Alex Birukov. And this talk is intentionally not much technical. Well, I suppose you are somewhat familiar with my cryptographic principles and some cryptographic tools, but I will not require much, and I will not go deeply into details of white box implementations. So I suppose that those who are interested will just go for reference and read appropriate papers. And the purpose of my talk would be somehow give you a brief picture of what white box cryptography is and what the problems are in this area. So probably many of you had heard this term, but you might have some troubles in actually defining it. But I should agree that it's really not a well-defined notion, this white box cryptography. So some people think that it's obfuscation, maybe. Some people think that it's almost the same as public key cryptography. Yes, it's also partially true. Some people think that it's just so badly defined that no one knows exactly what white box cryptography is. Well, all these versions are partially true. Okay, so I will proceed, and first I will give you some more or less detailed overview of my talk so you would know what to see in the next slides. So first I will talk about adversarial models. So when we talk about security of cryptographic primitives and schemes, we usually assume some standard model of an adversary. And when white box cryptography takes place, the model is non-standard, some unorthodox model, and this it's sometimes called man-at-the-end model. I will introduce this model to you, talk about some difference to a standard model. I will introduce this model to you in the context of contact protection, a protection of some media, well, movies, songs, whatever. I will give you some details about current protection schemes, and you will see when this model appears, and you will see that the main problem in this model is how to hide cryptographic keys. The keys that are assumed to be secret in standard models, but in this model, they are not secret, and our big problem is to hide them somewhere. Then, naturally, the notion of white box cryptography comes, and the crucial notion in the area of white box cryptography is the white box implementation of some cipher or a function, whatever. You will see that the majority of white box implementations of ciphers are built up on so-called lookup tables. It's just a large table stored in the memory, and you will see why this method is important. You will see how the famous block cipher AES, current encryption standard, is white boxed, so how a white box encoding of AES looks like. You will see how it can be cryptanalyzed, how an attack can be constructed, and how actually, and you will see why the initial proposal for white box AES is weak, and you will see why it is weak. And actually, you will see that many of such proposals are weak, and actually, no one is strong. I will then talk about weak and strong white box implementations because there can be different definitions in this aspect. And I will tell you that while weak white box implementations can be constructed somehow, but with strong white box implementation, we have serious problems. So theoretical background doesn't allow us to build this sort of cryptography, so-called strong white box cryptography. And then I will give you some, I will explain some new directions. How we try to build white box implementations, white box suitable ciphers from scratch, how we constructed a weak white box candidate, how we face the non-invertibility problem, and finally, how we try to construct white box cryptographic schemes from polynomials in finite fields. So this is a long overview of my talk, and now I will go deep into details. So throughout my talk, I consider protection of really large amounts of data. So these are huge databases, these are digital media of gigabytes or terabytes large. This is some scientific experiments data, so literally huge amounts stored on hard drives or in data centers. And of course, when processing and protecting this large amounts of data, performance is crucial. So we have to deal with primitives that are fast enough to enable processing the data in reasonable time. And when we talk about performance and security simultaneously, we usually work with so-called symmetric cryptography. So symmetric cryptography is some part of cryptography. It's called symmetric because secret components of some of ciphers, usually secret keys, are shared by parties. And the feature is that it's really fast compared to non-symmetric cryptography, to public key cryptography. So confidentiality and privacy are achieved usually with ciphers, of which the most widely known is AES block cipher. There are three versions of it, and the versions differ only in the key size. For us, it's not really important what the key size is. So the block cipher, it's called a block cipher because it processes blocks of fixed size, and to process large amounts of data, some modes of operation has to be used. So-called there are counter and chain modes of operation. So I provide you some abbreviations to help you some sort of recall things you've probably seen in various cryptographic implementations. And when we talk about when we want to achieve authenticity, when we want to protect integrity of the data, we usually deal with hash functions, message authentication codes, or larger authenticated encryption schemes. I gave you so much details about symmetric things because they have interesting features, so-called. So first I say that all these designs withstood years of cryptanalysis, years of attacks by different people, and their security are often backed up with various sorts of security proofs and arguments, but not so often with formal and rigorous mathematical proofs. Quite often, the security of all these schemes are based upon just observations, just some ideas why this particular cipher is strong and secure. And performance, why we love symmetric cryptography is for performance, did have some cost. While the RSA encryption is believed to be secure because it's directly related to a well-known mathematical problem, which is has been believed to be hard for centuries, the hardness of factoring large numbers. In contrast, AES block cipher is believed to be secure just because no one has ever broken it, ever published a successful attack, and many people tried. AES was designed so that it's easy enough to understand and easy enough to try any sort of attack, but it wasn't designed with a formal and rigorous security proof inside. So here's important difference. So here we achieve performance at the cost of not so much rigorous proofs. And when we talk about proofs and arguments, when we talk that some cipher is secure, we usually, of course, assume some more or less formal model of an adversary, of an attacker. A standard model where most of cryptographic algorithms, ciphers, or hash functions are evaluated, this model dates back to previous centuries, and usually we assume that the algorithm itself is open, publicly available for scrutiny, so everyone may try to find some weakness in the algorithm itself. But when the algorithm, when a scheme is used, the key is secret. Key is stored somewhere when an adversary cannot access it. It's in reality hidden in hardware. It's the code is running at some remote computer. And what an adversary is able to do is usually to observe inputs and outputs of a cipher, or possibly an adversary can supply some desired inputs to a cipher and observe its output. But it cannot control the key. And this is the standard model. This is the model that's usually used to assessing the security of cryptographic algorithms. However, quite often in practice, the latter assumption is very difficult to establish, and sometimes it's just doesn't hold. I mean, not it doesn't hold not in the sense that the key is public, no, but it's quite difficult to hide the key, and at some point we have to assume that we cannot hide the key, and we have to present it within the algorithm, but in quite a sophisticated way. When it happens, so the model, when the adversary has access to also to the key, is called man at the end, because it's usually we deal with some sort of application where cryptographic algorithms are performed, and an adversary has full access to this application. A typical example of a man-at-the-end model is as follows. So suppose you are a legitimate user or illegitimate user, any attacker, he just downloads a protected song from a server, I don't know, from by iTunes or whatever, and plays the song on an authorized music player. Of course, ideally, the copyright owners want to protect it in the sense that a person can, well, formally download it, but it can a user is not supposed to be able to distribute, to share this music elsewhere. And of course, adversaries may try to break this sort of protection. And in this scheme, an adversary has, well, generally speaking, has a lot of way to do this, because internet connection can be eavesdropped, the music player code can be viewed, also the code can be dynamically executed, and if there is some cryptographic transformation within, some cryptographic procedure, some scheme is running, then it's possible to view its internal variables and possibly read even the key. Because, well, in cryptographic algorithms, it's usually, if it's just normal code, it's quite easy to see when where the secret variables are located, and it's quite easy to locate the key if they are not hidden. And in this scheme, it's rather difficult to hide the key because, well, when in a software music player, there is not much way to store it. Of course, downloading songs is not the only application where you can face this sort of problem. So when you work with larger media, with the movies, for example, when movie owners broadcast the just produced cinema to movie theaters and want to protect it, when you download and play encrypted movies in some authorized players, or you just stream protected media directly, pretty much the same problems appear. And you probably heard that quite many of these protocols have been previously attacked. Well, how they were attacked, I've already described several vulnerability points, some potential vulnerability points, and indeed there are quite many ways to attack those algorithms. Consider some specific example. For example, protecting digital cinema is just a real-life example how movies are distributed from the owner to movie theaters. So first, server possesses some media, and then since the content is rather large, it's encrypted with symmetric cipher, AES, for instance. But the player doesn't know, by default, the key which was used to encrypt a particular movie, and the AES key must be attached somehow to the media, as you see here. So we have encrypted the content with the AES key, and we have to send it to the player. However, if we send a key, an AES key as a plain text, then it would be possible just directly to intercept it and to use it and decrypt the media elsewhere. So the AES key must be protected somehow. To do this, public key cryptography takes place. So RSA algorithm is much slower compared to AES, but to encrypt not so large key, it's pretty much sufficient. So in RSA algorithm, there are two keys, public key and private key. So suppose the player has RSA private key, then the server uses its counterpart public key to encrypt the AES key, and then attach it in the encrypted form, the ciphertext of the key, attach it to the media, and send it over to the player. And on the player side, the backward process is initiated. It means that the player uses its own private key to decrypt the AES key. Then this AES key is used to decrypt the media and to stream the content to a TV, to a screen, wherever. And quite typical is that the server wants to reduce his own workload, and if a server distributes a movie to thousands of theaters, then he doesn't want to encrypt the movie 1,000 times. It can be quite costly. And the key may repeat over theaters, over distributions. So in this quite much complicated schemes, you have probably noticed a lot of vulnerability points, a lot of points where this scheme can be attacked. So if we don't protect a device, its code, the use of memory, then, for example, an attacker might try to read the RSA key directly from the device memory and use it subsequently to decrypt, to make the later steps on his own. An attacker might try to read the RSA private key at the moment where it's used for decryption of AES key. Or finally, an attacker might try to eavesdrop the decryption process of the large content and might try to obtain the AES key itself. And quite famous attacks on DRM protected media protocols like CSS and AACS, all these protocols have been broken along this line. So attackers found the weakest link in such schemes and obtained encryption keys. And after those keys are obtained, it became rather easy to decrypt quite a lot of content. Well, you may wonder why we want to extract the keys, while it's sometimes possible to, via the methods of code lifting, to just extract the entire code of a player and use it for decryption. Well, quite often it's possible, but also quite often it's complicated because the decryption routine might not be isolated so easily. And handling keys is easier because keys are smaller, they're easy to distribute, it's easier to update a particular key if it's changed by a server. The keys are much more difficult to trace. So, for example, a software can be watermarked. And, well, if you can extract keys, it's always much better. In the further text, we can see the problem of hiding keys, not the problem of protecting the code from code lifting. So how can we hide those secret keys in such schemes? There are two well-known ways of hiding secret keys. First, one can try to store a key in well-protected hardware, which is tamper-proof. It's a success story, so this method works, and it has worked for years. Of course, it significantly increases the cost of an attack for an adversary, but hardware storage doesn't make an attack impossible, but it makes much more expensive. But on the other hand, while making the attack expensive for an adversary, this hardware method also makes the protection, the defense, more expensive for users because hardware has some non-zero costs, it's much less agile, it's much more difficult to update, and it can be vulnerable to all sorts of side-channel attacks like timing or power analysis. So storing keys in hardware is one way, and another way is storing keys somewhere in software. And when we talk about hiding the software, the internal variables in the source code somewhere, this is pretty much the same as we know as obfuscation. So obfuscation is another not really well-defined term, but we'll understand that it's just some method of concealing program's logic or behavior. There are quite many heuristic methods that obfuscate programs, but they all have some issues that do not allow us directly to use it to hide cryptographic keys. So some of them do not target keys specifically. Some of them are vulnerable to various sorts of static and dynamic analysis. And another problem is that the obfuscation is not well supported by theory. So on the theoretical side, we have quite many negative, well, also positive results, but we also have a negative results of sort that we cannot build a program that can obfuscate everything. On the other hand, we can obfuscate some very, very simple functions, so-called point functions, but there is no good results in between. There is no theoretical method that is just for the moment slow in theory, but just waits for its optimization. No, the situation is worse, and there are quite many heuristic methods, which are, well, not provably, they are very far from being provably secure, well, even convincingly secure. Okay, what I would like to elaborate a bit more on obfuscation. So if we cannot make something provably unbreakable, provably secure, we can follow the strategy of designing a block cipher and at least try to make something seemingly unbreakable, seemingly secure, and convincingly secure. We may remember that in the beginning of public cryptography, the way of obfuscating ciphers was proposed, but eventually public cryptography was built on mathematically hard problems. Okay, so if we talk about obfuscation, so how could we obfuscate keys, secret keys, and what sort of security we actually get? I mean, can we formally define any notion of security? Can we achieve this security? Can we somehow prove that we indeed get this sort of security from a particular implementation? And that's where white box cryptography appears. So white box cryptography deals with obfuscating secret cryptographic keys in software algorithms. So the crucial point for white box cryptography is a white box implementation of a cipher. It can be simply stated that white box cryptography is a white box implementation. So white box implementation is a pure software without any hardware help implementation of a cipher with key inside. So it's either decryption or encryption routine. It doesn't matter much because they're usually symmetric. And when analyzing its security, we first assume that this implementation is fully available to an adversary in its source code. So all the internal constants, tables, whatever are fully available to an adversary. And for defining security, well, first I use some not really some vague definition of security, but at least it gives you some understanding of what we want. So for a good white box implementation, an adversary that looks into it, she gets little to no advantage over a just black box implementation. So a black box implementation, it's the same implementation of a cipher, but where the key is hidden and we observe only plain text and ciphertext, but no internal variables. So if our white box implementation provides the same information as a black box one, it's good. But it's not a very rigorous definition. It will proceed with the definition further. So when you look at this list of requirements, you will see that it pretty much resembles public key cryptography. So why not using encryption schemes like RSA? Well, clearly because of performance. Yeah, we remember that performance is important, and we know that RSA is several orders of magnitude slower than AES. So for AES, I've taken, of course, the fastest implementation on recent Intel processors with appropriate instructions. So RSA also can be optimized somehow, but still a huge gap exists between the public key and symmetric cryptography speed. And when we talk about white box implementation of some cipher, of course, we want that performance loss should be minimal. So, of course, we cannot achieve the speed of naked AES. We can't achieve one cycle per byte, but we can achieve something in between, possibly. So that was the goal of the first designers of a white box implementation of some cipher, to obtain a white box implementation of AES or a similar cipher. And apparently people quickly realized that when designing the white box implementation of a cipher, our tools are very limited. Because when can we hide a key if everything is available to an adversary? So if we store a key as a constant, an adversary will see it. If we store a key as a function, an adversary will read this function, and this function is pretty much equivalent to a key. So where to hide it? Well, probably only in some sort of tables, in some very large tables from which the keys are quite difficult to extract. A very naive way to hide the key is just compose a so-called full code book, a lookup table for every plain text. So given a key, and for every plain text, we compute a ciphertext and store it in a large lookup table. But the problem is that conventional ciphers, and it's a requirement, they have quite large blocks, usually 128 bit, and such a table, of course, is impossible to generate and store. But the idea of hiding something in a large lookup table is really profitable. And, well, how about smaller key-dependent tables? They can implement any function in appropriate domain. So if we talk about tables that process 32-bit inputs at several gigabytes, well, not four, like here, but a bit more. So they can serve our purpose. But note, and it's very important, that all lookup tables that we compose are easily invertible. We will face the invertibility problem in the further slides, but you will see that if you are given a lookup table, then by properly sorting inputs or outputs, it can be easily inverted. And here we come to a white box implementation of AES, the design of this kind. So a group of researchers led by Stanley Cho in 2002, they simultaneously proposed white box implementations for both DES and AES. AES just appeared as a standard at that time. But I will talk only about AES because I found it easier to introduce AES as a cipher. So their idea was to obfuscate AES implementation with the key inside, to publish algorithm, and use mainly small lookup tables as algorithm's logic, and publish it as a sequence, the algorithm itself as a sequence of smaller table lookups, where input for each table is carefully composed of the outputs of previous table lookups. And their goal was, the security goal was to make the key recovery difficult. So the recovery of the internal key that's used in AES, so their goal was to hide the key. So their goal was not to make the cipher non-invertible to prevent decryption given encryption. It was possible, but their goal was rather limited to make the key recovery difficult. How did that? So here comes a bit of technical details. So AES is a so-called block cipher. So it processes 16-byte blocks of data. Well, as follows. So these 16 bytes are split into four blocks of size 32 bits. Well, here they're denoted as boxes as 32. And AES has structure of so-called 10 rounds, 10 almost identical transformations. And each transformation works as follows. So first, the key is taken. It's just XORed into the internal state, into every, well, it also has for 16 byte long, and it's just XORed to every byte. Then every byte undergoes some nonlinear transformation called subbytes. And then a linear transformation is applied to every block of 4 bytes wide. And after this sequence of 3 operations, these 16 bytes are permuted. And this is done 10 times. So pretty much the same 10 times. So the key is a bit different every time to prevent some very specific sort of attacks. But the main picture is like this. So the main point of this description is that AES splits its input into 4 blocks. So 4 blocks undergoes some specific transformation. And then the bytes are permuted. That's the thing. And having this picture in mind, the designers of the first white box implementation, they proceeded as follows. So their goal was to hide the key K in this scheme. And they had to do this at every round. We'll consider only one round, but the procedure is pretty much the same in other ones. So now I will describe a white box encoding of AES round. I will, well, the original idea was much more complicated than I describe here, and it was much more optimized. So what I describe here is first a stronger version, and second, it requires much more memory. And even though this version that I describe here is stronger, it still can be broken and badly broken. So you don't lose anything in listening to my view of what they've done. So the original version was just a bit weaker, but also smaller. So the designers worked mainly with these 32-bit blocks. So they left this byte permutation apart, and their goal was to hide the key. So what they did, they secretly generated linear transformations P and Q, made them some sort of mutually compensative, so that if you put P right after Q, they would compensate each other, so that the encryption process would still be the same. But this 32-bit block, it will operate a bit differently. And their idea was to hide this secret key between the two secret linear transformations. So they generated these transformations for every round and for every block. And the resulting 32-bit block, they just computed a full lookup table, which is, again, key-dependent and has 2 to the 32 entries. Well, originally less, but we'll assume that it's just like this. So 2 to the 32 entries, and they stored all these tables in memory. And having like this, so the 10 rounds of AES were just sequences of these tables and byte permutations, tables and table lookups and byte permutations. And this worked pretty much the same as original AES. And well, the same idea was used for the DES cipher. But the problem of all this implementation, they can be badly broken. So the well-known method of differential cryptanalysis applies to all these proposed implementations. So the idea of differential cryptanalysis is that we consider differences, well, bitwise difference between pairs of inputs. So I recall that the full lookup table is available to the adversary, and looking at inputs, you can compute the difference of inputs and difference of outputs. And the attack worked briefly as follows. So we consider multiple inputs, and we look, we consider the evolution of difference between them, and we just guess that for some pair of inputs, the difference becomes, after it goes through linear transformations, it becomes non-zero only in one S-box. Well, possibly in two S-boxes, but suppose they're in one. And the next important thing is that these input pairs, they form some sort of linear space. This linear space can be detected, and it can be detected because the output difference, they form a matrix, and this matrix, it has low rank because all these output differences of size 32 bits, they were generated out of a difference in only one byte, in 8-bit. So some very simple algebraic properties are used, and this is enough to detect the case when these differences shrink to only one byte, to recover P and Q, and subsequently to recover, well, P and Q are recovered up to some linear equivalence, and then the key can be simply, well, these layers are removed, and then the key can be simply guessed from this lookup tables. It's very simple. And with other optimizations, the entire key from the whole white box implementations can be extracted in just 2 to the 30 operations, which is on modern desktop is just seconds. And all the subsequent ideas and proposals were refinements of this simple principle, and they all were broken. Part of problem why they were broken because, well, having only two linear transformations and one nonlinear layer is not enough. There is a paper more than 10 years old that shows that even if we had three nonlinear layers here, then they can still be attacked. And when we consider AES, there is only one nonlinear layer in AES round 10. This scheme, even if we surround it with unknown P and Q, it can still be easily attacked. And generally, the table-based approach, the approach based on lookup tables, it fails for AES. It also fails for many other ciphers just because of structure of AES. Because if we consider smaller part of a cipher for which lookup tables can be constructed, smaller ones, then only a small part of the key is hidden here, only 32 bits. And if we consider a larger part of AES, then the tables become too large. So hiding an entire key would require enormously large tables, which you cannot allow. And all this table-based approach that fail for AES and other ciphers. So some different design is required to... So a cipher must have completely different design, and the key must be injected in different ways to be suitable for a white box implementation. So here is just an overview of other proposals. So all that AES white box implementations have been broken. All the DES white box implementations have been broken quite many years ago. All the attacks have practical complexity, and indeed, if an adversary ever gets the full entire code with these tables, it can be easily broken. But to my great surprise, well, everything indeed is broken. To my great surprise, there are quite many proprietary solutions on the market from different companies, including companies started by people who made the first white box implementations, and they are certainly aware of the existing attacks. So these solutions probably combine, well, these weak academic proposals with some additional obfuscation techniques, and we don't know anything about their security. Well, there are no public attacks on these schemes. Maybe they have been, there were attacks, but they are not published. So I recommend you not to trust these schemes at all, because academically, there is no strong white box scheme. So, the previous white box implementations there are devoted to key recovery, but what about other security goals? So can we use this principle of white box implementation for something else? So one definition, which we denote the so-called weak white box cryptography, deals with the key recovery security, so-called. It's the goal that an adversary cannot extract the key from the code. Well, this definition was chronologically first, and it's apparently easier to achieve even though these previous implementations were broken. But when indeed the code lifting is used, then this definition is irrelevant, because when you can use your white box implementation as a decryption routine, then why to care about key recovery? It's useless. So people introduced another definition of so-called strong white box cryptography, where we require that even though the implementation is published, the adversary cannot invert the cipher. So it cannot get a decryption routine from a publicly available encryption routine. And an encryption routine is available together with embedded key. It applies in the case of code lifting, but also it's almost identical to public key cryptography. And the problem is that it's as difficult to design as public key cryptographic schemes. And all the existing proposals for white box implementation, they don't comply to this definition at all. They are all easily invertible. And when we started our research on white box cryptography, so we started thinking that indeed, so if current ciphers are not so much suitable for white box implementations. Even key recovery security is difficult to achieve. So does the situation change if we make a white box suitable cipher from scratch? Well, apparently it does, at least for key recovery security. So we can claim that we can achieve key recovery secure weak white box cryptography in our proposal. And the idea is, so if we have the goal of just hide the key in a table, then it's apparently easy. So you just take an AES-like cipher, for example, consider a 32-bit cipher, and then just take a 128-bit key and apply AES 32-bit block, then some linear transformation, and inject the key, apply AES 32-bit transformation, and then make a linear transformation and inject the key, and do this, say, 20 times, so that the every byte of the key is used 5 times. And make a huge a lookup table out of it. If you want a cipher with a larger block, you can make this in parallel and mix the outputs. So the key will be perfectly hidden. Security margin is even larger than in regular AES. But the problem, of course, it's trivially invertible, because given this lookup table, it's rather easy to obtain the plain text from a ciphertext. And this is the problem of every table-based white box cryptography. Since, well, because of their of the implementation size, lookup tables allow inputs only up to 32 bits, sort of. And we just don't know, it's really an open problem, how to compose lookup tables so that they cannot be invertible easily by an adversary. So we might allow that they can be invertible if you know the key, if you know how these tables were structured, but if the adversary doesn't know the key, he cannot invert it. And we don't know how to do it, so doing this would solve a pretty good problem in cryptography. It's pretty much similar to what we know as one-way permutations. So-called trapdoor permutations were introduced in the beginning of public cryptography, and things like RSA hash functions, RSA encryption function is an example of a trapdoor permutation. And they are believed, the only problem is that believed to be secure, well, considered secure, for really large n, for which the performance is usually not attractive. And for smaller n, for reasonable performance, this is still an open problem. We also consider some algebraic constructions, because we know that inverting vector functions, which are even degree two polynomials over finite fields, is difficult. And the problem is you cannot make such a polynomial random enough to hide this trapdoor inside. And there are quite many proposals in this area called multivariate cryptography, and they were all broken. Unfortunately, so the whole scheme looks like there is a publicly available polynomial A. It's surrounded by affine transformations S and T. And, well, it's invertible because of properties of A. But unfortunately, the families of invertible polynomials are pretty small, and all these schemes have been attacked, pretty many of them. Some work in progress in our direction is to consider two-layer schemes, where we would have two nonlinear layers, A1, A2, and some supplementary level, nonlinear level A3, where we eventually get polynomials of degree 4, and S, T, and U here are affine invertible transformations, but this is still pretty much work in progress. So there is some hope to build white box, good white box cryptography on the algebraic basis, but it's far from being explored and finished. And so short summary, that white box cryptography initially was aimed to obfuscate encryption or decryption routines with keys inside. It's indeed quite similar to public key cryptography, and the main feature of existing proposals that they are all weak and they have been broken, so use every solution, white box cryptography solution that is offered on the market with a great care. And we are afraid that just good white box solutions do not exist, but if they exist, it would be a really good solution to an open problem. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dimitri. I expect after this talk a lot of questions. If you have questions, could you line up at the microphones put up here in the room? And I want to ask our signal angel up there, do you have any questions from the internet? No. No questions from the internet. How about questions from inside the room? Okay, go ahead, please.
It's more of a practical application question. From the text you've shown, and always referring to that asymmetric encryption is too slow to be feasibly in a practical context, what improvement would I get using asymmetric encryption? Because the problem is the user or its end device, which is not his own, obviously, has to do the decryption. So the interesting part in the first place is the description key. So using asymmetric encryption, it would keep me from, after extracting the decryption key in several ways you described, asymmetric encryption would keep me from obtaining the encryption key. No, it wouldn't. So what it bring? What's the good part about, yeah?
Well, let me scroll a bit to the first example. So as you might see here, so you have a pretty much large content. So if you encrypt it just with asymmetric cryptography, it will be just very slow. You cannot encrypt it with asymmetric cryptography. If you encrypt only with symmetric cryptography, and the key to this to symmetric scheme encrypted with asymmetric cryptography, then it becomes vulnerable while this symmetric key is used. And if you have a good white box scheme here that you can replace both encryptions in this scheme with just one white box scheme, so if its performance is good enough, then the key cannot be recovered in this scheme, and performance loss would be much smaller compared to the total use of asymmetric cryptography. So does that answer the question?
Perhaps I just missed the point of the complete speech a bit, because in the end, all the white box encryption schemes look a bit like, well, it's obfuscation to me. It's not a really different quality than obfuscation, is it?
They are not much different from obfuscation, and yes, it can be simply stated that it's just obfuscation of symmetric schemes. But this obfuscation, it really brings us to the world of public cryptography, so they're just creatures in between.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, then microphone number 4 in the center of the room, please.
Thank you for your talk. I had a question on, because you mentioned these lookup tables and making them hard to invert, and then you said that you tried trapdoor functions, or someone tried to get trapdoor functions, and that was performance-wise really difficult. And I can imagine that you can't do any better than trapdoor functions. So that you can prove that if a trapdoor function is just too hard to use, then you won't find anything better. Have you looked at impossibility proofs there?
Well, the fact that we would not like impossibility proofs because we can possibly prove that some sort of trapdoors are impossible, but maybe we don't need something that is provably non-invertible here. Maybe we can hope for something like for AES that is just seemingly non-invertible. It's okay to not having a formal and rigorous proof that it is a good trapdoor, but it could be okay if that's just many people tried to invert it and didn't succeed. So that's our hope, to get away from rigorous proofs here. So this impossibility is not what we would really like.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, microphone number 2, please.
So I'm not an expert in cryptography, but my understanding is that in symmetric cryptography, you have the same key for both decryption and encryption. So isn't it, why do you care so much about invertibility? Isn't it an important attack vector to, if the attacker is able to basically rerun the ciphertext through whatever method you use, and then to get the plain text again, it doesn't matter how you implement it, even if you obfuscate it, he just gets the plain text again by just rerunning whatever you have implemented? Isn't that an important vector of attack?
Well, so in symmetric cryptography, you have a cipher. So if you have an algorithm, and if you are given a key, that you can easily run it in both directions. If you're given a table, a so-called full code book table, you can again invert it and use it in both directions. But the idea is to give you some sort of an algorithm with key and with embedded key so that you cannot invert it easily. To give you some sort of function that you know how to run it in forward direction, but it's obfuscated in a way that you cannot run it in backward direction. You can imagine it like, suppose you have two functions of the same input, you just XOR the outputs.
Of course.
How would you invert it?
But I mean, my point was that couldn't you just rerun it on the ciphertext to get the plain text again, basically?
No, so decryption algorithm is not the same.
Maybe not, obviously not that easily, but yeah. I mean, isn't it some possible way of attacking that?
No, not really. So the decryption algorithm is not the same one. So it's easily obtainable from the encryption one, but usually it's a different one.
Okay.
Okay, then we can have one question per microphone. Back there, number three, please.
If I understand it correctly, if you have the classical problem of the DRM is that you have the algorithm that decrypts it, because you have it, you have to have it to play the movie, to play the music or whatever. So I understand that hiding the key would be somehow good for the implementators of the DRM, because it makes it slightly harder to implement the attack. But if you basically I can see how it would be possible to break to not allow the attack that uses the code that you have for playing.
Well, it's formally it's impossible. So in many implementations, you can indeed easily extract the code and use it as your own routine. But this is some sort of solution for the cases when this is not easily. So this, if you have this white box implementation that it's immediately increases the attack costs, it will require the adversary to use just the code that it was given and not anything else. So it limits the adversary's capabilities somehow, and that's at least some partial achievement.
Okay, microphone number one.
Yeah, hey. First, I want to thank you for the presentation because it helped shedding some light on the mysterious topic of white box cryptography. And it helped me calling out bullshit on the whole idea, and I think somebody should make this critical comment because the whole concept breaks with one of the principles of cryptography, that an algorithm should be verifiable, right? So if you obfuscate it to hide something, if it's only hiding the key, it's no use because I wouldn't go after the implementation at all. I would have other ways to attack and recover the key. Everybody knows how easy that is. And if it obfuscates more or even changes it, then it breaks with the principle of being verifiable, right? So I think the whole thing is snake oil and shouldn't be used by anybody.
Thank you for the comment.
Okay, last question from microphone number four over there, please.
I just have a two-part question. Can you achieve white box properties with homomorphic encryption theoretically? And the second part is, can you do that practically?
Yes, well, I think with most of public key schemes, you can achieve this. The problem is, again, performance. I would say so. I think performance is the main problem that prevents us from using candidates from things like homomorphic encryption or the latest that they're based on. So, things like that.
There have been some recent improvements, 2012, 2013, in fully homomorphic schemes. Do they bring the sort of level down to where this may be practical for white box properties, or have you not looked into this?
Well, I didn't really think in this direction of fully homomorphic encryption. If you give me just some time offline, I have to think about it and probably give you a better sure. answer.
Okay, Dimitri, well, thank you very much for your talk.
Thank you again.